This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
I remember when I was in Sana'a, Yemen's capital, in 2013, and I was with some tribesmen who were protecting me, who came from the east of the country where I work. And whenever we heard gunfire or shots, which isn't uncommon in Sana'a, they would fall about laughing, saying, Al-Hiwar al-Watani, which means the national dialogue, because to them, it was completely obvious that this was a civil war in waiting. We in the West, we were the only ones who hadn't sussed that yet.
But we in the West are beginning to suss it now.
As the House will be aware, Yemen is one of the most serious humanitarian crises in the world.
The tragedy for me, and that's why you have these proxy wars being fought the whole time in that area, is that there's not strong enough leadership in the countries themselves.
Civil war in Yemen has become a full regional conflict with global implications. But what on earth is it all about? Finding out the answers to questions like that is what the briefing room is for. And joining me in it today to discuss the war are Dr. Elizabeth Kendall, who splits her time between teaching Arabic at Oxford and hanging out with armed tribesmen in Yemen, and Safa Al-Ahmed, a Saudi Arabian filmmaker and journalist who's reported from Yemen's front lines. I'll be talking to Safa about her experiences in a moment, but first, some basic information. Elizabeth Kendall, what is Yemen?
Yemen is a relatively new invention. It only came together as a whole country in about 1990, and already 4 years later, there was a civil war between the north part of the country and the south. But Yemen is also the poorest country in the Arab world. Why would we therefore care about it? Well, it's quite populous. It has about 27 million inhabitants. And actually, right now, about 20 million of them are in need of humanitarian assistance. It's also in a very important geostrategic position. It's located in the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula, has a very long border of about 2,000, roughly, kilometres to Saudi Arabia. It has a coastline, which includes a maritime border to Somalia, and it also has a border to Oman. In that location, it controls the access to the Red Sea through the Bab el-Mandab Strait. So that's why we're concerned about it.
Elizabeth Kendall, thank you very much for that rather brilliant introduction. And we'll be coming back to you in a moment. Safa Al-Ahmed was one of the very few journalists reporting from the ground in Yemen during the escalation of the crisis between Houthi rebels, militant groups and the government. She's been to both sides of the conflict. Safa, who are the Houthis? Where do they come from?
The story of the Houthis is fascinating, actually, because if you watched it from the beginning, it's the rise of this tiny, tiny little cult in the top northern mountains of Yemen that was very isolated into, arguably, the biggest, most powerful militia that controls Yemen. And to see that rise is quite fascinating. So to me, Hussein al-Houthi, who was the founder of this organization.
So the Houthis are named after a person?
After a person, Hussein al-Houthi. And he was a Zaydi revivalist. So Zaydism is a very small sect in Islam that is mostly found in Yemen and most particularly in the northern part of Yemen.
Kind of Shia.
Yes, it's Zaydism is under the branch of Shiism, but not at all similar to the Shiism in Iran. It's a very different school of thought.
OK. Is this guy still alive?
No. He was killed by the government in the first war that the Yemeni government waged against the Houthis.
So they were nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then they got into a kind of war with the government.
Yes.
And the kind of things that they were saying got them more and more supporters.
Yes, because they were seen as oppressed by the government. There were six consecutive wars on Sa'da, which is the area in the north of Yemen where they're from. And so six wars consecutively in 10 years gave the Houthis excellent training in how to fight the government. And that's how they became a militia, a very well-armed, well-trained militia.
OK, now you met them.
Yes.
When and where did that happen?
So when I first met several Houthis was in 2011 with the beginning of the revolution in Yemen against Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was the president at the time, and he was in power for over 30 years. And so it was part and parcel of the bigger uprisings in the Arab world. Because of the revolution, it broke the isolation of the Houthis in the north, and they started going down to Sana'a, which is the capital of Yemen, and joined all the other political groups that were demonstrating against the president.
So at that stage, they were part of the anti-Saleh forces.
Yes. The Houthis were in a revolution against Ali Saleh.
Yeah.
Coming to 2015, they are now allies with Ali Saleh against the other factions.
Now, tell me more about what you discovered when you actually met them.
So, you know, meeting the Houthis is not difficult. Getting them to trust you and to give you access is extremely difficult. They're extremely suspicious. They don't trust anyone, especially journalists. I was very lucky because I got to talk to them. And even then, it was very difficult. They were very suspicious. But for example, they let me go to Sa'da with them to the north where everything started with Hussein and Houthi. And it was fascinating to see the mountains and to realize how isolated they were. And to see where he started giving his lectures and to see the mountains where they were fighting against the government. All of that gives you a deeper appreciation of the mentality of the Houthis, the sense of besiegement and victimhood. And so I talked to a Shami who's representative of the Houthis, and he told me that.
After the September 11 attacks, we were euphoric and proud of this stand against America. But the Sayyid had a different opinion. He said it was actually an American and Zionist ploy to attack Islam. He launched the slogan that still resonates and shakes the Americans and the Israelis.
And he's talking about the very famous slogan of the Houthis, death to America, death to Israel, God curse the Jews, victory to Islam.
Safa, that slogan, that's all a bit familiar, really. I mean, where does that ideology come from?
Definitely he was affected by the Iranian Revolution in 79 and Khomeini and the slogans, the anti-imperialist, anti-American, anti-Israeli sentiment that they had, especially in the beginning of the revolution. He was definitely inspired by that.
How significant is it that the Houthis originate in the border area with Saudi Arabia?
Very significant, because that plays into the relationship with the Saudis very directly. A lot of people in that area specifically also use the Saudi rial, as in the Saudi currency. There's a lot of business going back and forth, even the black market, because it's much cheaper to buy oil and certain products in Saudi Arabia and then bring it across the border into Yemen. So historically, the relationship is there. What is contentious is the start of specific Salafi schools in Sa'da, in the north.
Salafism, which is this extremist form of Islamist ideology.
A fundamental school of Islam. And they saw that as a direct threat to Zaydism. And that started like in the 70s. And that contentious relationship lasted until now. What made it even worse between the Houthis and the Saudi government is the direct involvement of the Saudis in 2009 in one of the wars against them. And so there was aerial bombardments and massive devastation in Sa'da because of the intervention of the Saudis on the border. And it is quite clear that that had a lot of impact on the Houthis. And so when I was there on the border, we stood literally on that border with the barbed wire. And I asked Shami a specific question. It's like, how do you feel about this border? And he gave me a fascinating line.
It means nothing. It represents nothing. If the relationship between the Yemeni and the Saudi Arabian people is strengthened, then it will ease the fall of the House of Al-Saud. Yes, it will be a painful surgical procedure, but in the end, there will be healing from the sickness.
How did the Houthis get to seize control of the capital? I mean, as you said, tiny group originally. Eventually, they actually take the capital.
Yes. In 2014, they had already were surrounding the capital and sit-ins. In September 18 of 2014, they start taking over the capital. By the 21st of September, they had complete control of the capital and they had signed a peace agreement with the then President Hadi.
So Hadi had now taken over from Saleh. Saleh had been ousted, who they didn't like.
He didn't like.
They got a peace deal with Hadi.
Hadi, who used to be the vice president of Ali Saleh. So there wasn't a massive change in regime, to be honest. But between the 18th and 21st, they were able to take over an entire capital. And that, to me, signifies not the power of the Houthis, but the weakness of the government. And that is, I think, the true devastation of Yemen. None of these militias or political groups are that powerful to take over the entire country. But because the government is so weak, this is why we are where we are today.
So what do the Houthis want?
I think they want power. What they're doing with it is an excellent thing because they are not equipped to run a country. And this is why Ali Saleh and his men are back in power in many parts of the government in Sana'a, because the Houthis do not have the capabilities or the knowledge or the know-how to run a country.
So they put some of Saleh's people back. Now, we've heard already that Yemen used to be North Yemen and South Yemen and so on. The Houthis have taken over North Yemen. Has that kind of recreated the divide between the North and the South?
Absolutely. I mean, and the sensitivities between the North and the South, especially when the Houthis tried to take over Aden, which is in South Yemen. And I think that moment of hubris of the Houthis thinking that they could take over the city of Aden and the bloodshed that they committed in Aden was one of those watershed moments where no longer was South Yemen able or to consider the northerners part and parcel of the same country. And now there's a de facto two states, if not many more.
How did they treat the people in Aden then?
There were massacres, there are human rights violations. I mean, and they did this in the summer. I mean, Yemen is extremely hot and already very, very, very poor. So you can imagine under the conditions of war and besiegement, the situation was dire. And so the people of Aden will never forget, I think, the attack of the Houthis.
And what do the Sunni more generally in the south feel about the Houthis?
And so this is one of the sad things about the Houthi takeover of parts of Yemen. The conflict no longer was north-south or tribal or geographic or political. It started taking sectarian language. And that is very unfortunate and very bloody. And just like we saw in Syria and in Iraq, that devastates the fabric of society. And unfortunately, that is what started to happen in Yemen. And so a lot of groups, like, for example, Al-Qaeda, saw it as sectarian. They saw the Houthis as allies of Iran and Shia, and thus we have to fight them on sectarian basis. That, to me, causes a lot of trouble. And when I was there, we talked to one of them, very important Sunni tribes, and he said it quite clearly.
I can't accept, as a tribal man, it's my religious responsibility as a Sunni, as a southerner. As a Sunni southerner, I can never accept the Houthi. They blow up mosques and schools and then scream death to America, death to Israel. So this mosque where the words God is great are said belong to America or Israel? Let me be honest, even if Al-Qaeda and I have disagreements, if we're fighting in the same trenches against the Houthi, he becomes my brother in arms.
You see here how he's mixing between geography and sect, and that has become something very, very, very dangerous. And at the time, even those people were looking forward to something that was even stronger and more fundamental than Al-Qaeda. And just like this other tribal man was saying.
I'm among those who love al-Baghdadi and love Islamic State and ask God to make them victorious. Why? Because you see their victories with your own eyes. We used to put a lot of faith in democracy and nonviolence, but what has that done for us? This is our hope. to be ruled by Islam and freed from occupation, from the Shia. Islamic State is a reality, and they control land. They will take over districts and will engage in direct battle.
I find this one of the saddest moments for me when I hear somebody talk about the failure of democracy and nonviolence. But this is the reality in the entire region. We have dictatorships that have made political dissent so bloody that people will look up to people like Baghdadi and the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda as the only ways to fight a dictatorship.
Safa, thank you for sharing some of those scary insights from the front line. Oxford academic Elizabeth Kendall, who you heard from earlier, knows better than most what ordinary Yemenis think. 4 years ago, she decided to organise an opinion poll of them. This is her explaining to a room full of armed men in eastern Yemen why Oxford University wants their help to carry out the survey. They're all quite heavily armed, and you're an unarmed Western woman, Elizabeth. What was it like travelling around rural Yemen?
Surprisingly delightful. I think that the stereotypes of aggressive, warlike, kidnapping tribesmen are a little bit overplayed. Of course the dangers are there, but I can only stress the fantastic hospitality that I encountered. And of course, being a woman also has its advantages, because it means you can talk to 100% of the population. I can talk to the women as well as the men, and therefore I get a much greater insight into the workings of the inner society.
Boris Johnson mentioned a proxy war. So how accurate is it to describe this war as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia on the one side and Iran on the other?
I think that it is truer now than it was when the war first began. I don't think that this conflict began as a proxy war. However, Saudi Arabia has genuine concerns about Iranian influence expanding across the Middle East, and in particular on its doorstep in Yemen. Some of that concern is justified. Iran doesn't really help matters by saber-rattling and talking up its role inside Yemen, partly to goad Saudi Arabia, I think, and to egg it on. Now, we know that Iran is providing some weapons to the Houthis. But we have to be careful before we put all the blame at the door of Iran. Don't forget that, for example, the latest WikiLeaks documentation from a couple of weeks ago showed very clearly that the West was supplying Yemen with all sorts of weapons. And some of that went to the Houthis as late, according to WikiLeaks, as October 2014. That's just 5 months before the war started.
So this is weaponry that was given to the Yemeni government, the official government, and then taken over by the Houthis
partly,
for their own deployment.
Partly given to the Houthis by President Hadi and before that President Saleh in order to fight terrorism in the country, but also partly given to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh's Republican Guard, which, of course, is now aligned with the Houthis.
So this is a classic example of putting some weaponry in one place and then discovering that somebody else has got their hands on it. It's not because we've actually consciously wanted to support the Houthis.
Exactly.
But also don't forget that Yemen is notorious for arms markets. I mean, you can buy tanks on Facebook and guns and all these things. What is happening now more, I think very little has been proven about any of these things. But the allegations are that the Iranians are providing more advanced weaponry.
Now, there have been big criticisms of our supplying of the Saudis with military equipment recently because of the uses that they've made of it. So I'm trying to get a handle on this. Do we actually support what the Saudis are doing in Yemen? Or do we just supply them with weapons because we supply the Saudis, our allies, with weapons?
Well, I think we're supplying the Saudis with weapons because we have a long tradition, history and an economy that supplies Saudis with weapons. We're not going to suddenly stop supplying them until I think people wake up to the fact that the weapons we're supplying are being used in airstrikes, one in three of which seems to be hitting a civilian target.
So do you think privately we're asking the Saudis to, would you mind please, A, being a lot more careful, and B, if you could manage to stop for a while, that wouldn't be a bad thing?
I'm sure we are, in fact, doing that. The problem, of course, is that nobody wants to embarrass the Saudis publicly. But I am fairly convinced that those kinds of conversations must be going on behind closed doors.
Let's look at a moment at the thing which has kind of preoccupied the West about Yemen, which was firstly the rise of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and latterly the possibility of Islamic State. Elizabeth Kendall, are Western leaders right to be worried about al-Qaeda and Islamic State in Yemen?
Yes, they are right to be worried. Over 2015, we saw a fourfold rise in the numbers of mujahideen recruits joining al-Qaeda, which is a bigger problem in Yemen than Islamic State. And, of course, the reason for that was partly because of the war. It was an unintended consequence of the war that was being waged in the west of the country that al-Qaeda was able to gain territory and create a de facto state in the east of the country. Now, since April this year, when UAE special forces, with some help from their friends, moved in to that de facto state.
United Arab Emirates.
Yes, United Arab Emirates. It's easy to believe that the problem has gone away. And on the surface, it does appear to have dwindled. Al-Qaeda has melted away, it's gone to ground, and it has only some particular fronts on which it's still continuing to fight. But we saw this before. We saw this in 2012 when everyone lauded themselves for having defeated al-Qaeda. And at the earliest opportunity, as the state became weak again, up it came. It re-emerged, it resurged. And so
I think it's even worse than that, because I was there in 2012. And after the government took over areas like Jaar, Zanjibar, people wanted al-Qaeda back because the forces were so corrupt in comparison to al-Qaeda that they wanted the safety and security, quote unquote, that al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula had brought to the regions.
Well, Safa, that is an incredibly important point, because what we tend to miss is that al-Qaeda is popular not because of the recruits.
Or the ideology.
Or the ideology. But it's because of the passive toleration it's able to win in marginalised communities. Mm-hmm. It's because it listens to local concerns and tries to do something about them. Before then, of course, grafting its ideology of international militant jihad on top of that.
If I can give an example of, like, they gave me footage of them reconnecting a small village to electricity. And this village didn't have electricity for 20 years, right? And you see that shot of them flicking the switch and the light bulb flickers to light. And everybody's like, Allahu Akbar. They were ecstatic. They were so happy. And that just, they don't care what the ideology of al-Qaeda is. They don't even have a concept of what is the international image of it. They care that an organization had come in, provided them with electricity, running water. They were building sewage. All those things are practical implications of what it means to have them there.
Now, in the context of this war, Elizabeth Kendall, whose side are al-Qaeda and, insofar as it's there, Islamic State actually on? Presumably they're against the Houthis because they've got some links to Iran and the Shia.
They are. They're against the Houthis. And so in that sense, at least, you could say that they're on the side of the Saudi Arabian-led coalition. We have seen them fight directly alongside coalition forces.
Now, you've seen this directly, haven't you, Safa? I mean, when you tried to get into that third city on the front line, you found al-Qaeda people on the front line.
Absolutely, yes.
Fighting alongside the anti-Houthi forces.
Yeah, and also blowing up the same forces they're fighting with inside Aden. So, I mean, it just complicates the relationship.
Safa, one of the things that strikes me, listening to everything that you've said, is to question really whether or not there's a future for this country at all as a unitary state. It seems really difficult to hold the bits of it together. Do you think it can be a successful political entity again?
I think in reality right now, a unified Yemen doesn't exist.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I think we have two major stumbling blocks in our approach to Yemen. I do believe that our Minister for the Middle East and Africa, Tobias Elwood, is doing great work trying to bring people together to tackle it. But he has two major problems. One is A unified Yemen is simply not a natural state of affairs. And, you know, we really need to find genuine representatives and stop calling President Hadi the legitimate president of Yemen.
But the UN recognises him as the legitimate president of Yemen. And as we know, there's an incredible difficulty, legally and in other ways, with deciding that he isn't.
Well, I think you have to ask yourself, what makes him legitimate? He won an election, that's true, in February 2012.
Running in that election.
He was the sole candidate. And he was only supposed to be an interim president for 2 years. So his term actually should have run out in February 2014.
And has run out.
And somebody who sits in a luxury hotel in Riyadh supervising the bombing of his own country has no future inside Yemen. So even if by some miracle he were to agree peace with the Houthis, he would still have no future inside Yemen. We are talking to the wrong people.
But I also believe in the people's agency, and that it is ultimately the Yemenis themselves that have to decide. This is no longer beneficiary for anybody inside Yemen to continue. I mean, the fragile alliances that are happening right now are only temporary. And a lot of the Yemeni leadership are the ones who caused the total devastation of Yemen that we see today. So even this, if the Saudi war stopped yesterday, there would still be fighting in Yemen. Right. And we need to understand those local dynamics, and we need to give people their agency as well. The Saudis play a role, the Americans, the British, the Omanis, the Iranians. Yes. But ultimately, it is the Yemenis themselves and their leaderships that have to come to terms with stopping what's going on.
Elizabeth Kendall, if you had to guess about what structure a halfway successful solution would take, what form it would take, what would that guess be?
I'm going to guess at something that will be hugely unpopular in political circles because it goes against the grain of how people like to think, how policymakers like to think about nation-state creating. Yemen, to my mind, needs to be as many pieces as possible. Currently, it's 21 governorates, and the idea that it could split successfully into north-south when those pieces are fighting amongst themselves, or north, south, east, or indeed the six pieces that were suggested for the federal solution in 2014, is not viable. We will still continue to see infighting. We need to give as much devolved power to the regions as we possibly can.
Let me just try and sum up what I think I've gathered from this discussion. I mean, this may be a proxy war involving Saudi Arabia and Iran, but actually the principal players in it are Yemenis themselves. They're the people who are making it happen and the people who can stop it from happening. But the big question is whether or not actually they can do it in the context of maintaining one single Yemen. And there seems to be a little bit of a consensus around the table that actually probably they can't. And we ought to be looking at brokering a deal that might mean the breakup of Yemen. Well, thank you very much for that, Elizabeth Kendall and Safa Al-Ahmed. Join us next week to discuss, well, who knows? You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. My producer for this episode was Hannah Sander. Research was by Beth Sager-Fenton. And the programme was recorded by James Beard. We're always grateful to hear what people think of The Briefing Room. And if you'd like to let us know your views, there's an easy way to do it. Just leave a rating, or even better, a review, on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.